It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Want to welcome everybody to the Knights Mountain Report. I'm excited. I got another Western Pennsylvania guy on, but before we begin, remember, the views and opinions of this show are those of the host and guest, and please don't take it out on anyone else, please. Thank you. And before I forget, don't forget, right towards the end of the show, I'm going to read another fun iTunes review. I think I'm going to pick one of my people that didn't like me. I like those. I'm hoping more people leave good ones, but yeah, the bad ones are just as fun for me because I enjoy them. So, my guest tonight is Charles Reichenbaum, or Dr. Knowledge. I think we're just going to stick with Dr. Knowledge. How's that sound? That's How are you doing right. tonight? How are you doing?
Okay. Good being with you, Jim.
Where did that come from, Dr. Knowledge?
I was doing a bunch of radio talk shows around the country, and there were two different hosts that gave me that name. My original book series was called Knowledge in a Nutshell. And I had a talk show host in Kansas City, started calling me Dr. Knowledge because of the titles of the books were Knowledge in a Nutshell. And then the same thing happened with a talk show host in Houston. He came up with the name Dr. Knowledge, so I figured, well, that's pretty good. So I've been using that ever since. And actually, our new book doesn't have the words Knowledge in a Nutshell in it. It's called The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. But for people to see it, our website is knowledgeinanutshell.com, and the name of our new book is The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. But that Dr. Knowledge really just came from those two radio talk show hosts who came up with a good name.
I was going to say, that's just about right for what I would like based off seeing what you do. So next thing, this isn't wasn't part of my original prep for the interview, but as you know, things change in the world. You a little scared about going downtown at all with the bus falling in the sinkhole?
With the bucks falling.
Maybe.
They really cleaned house. They fired the manager, the general manager, the bench coach, the pitching coach.
They even fired me, I hear, but I haven't got the letter yet in the mail. So.
they really did clean house after the season.
It was about time. I'll leave it there. Okay. Enough of that kind of inside joke kind of stuff for anybody who doesn't live in Pittsburgh, because I'm pretty sure there isn't Pirates fans too far around anymore. But anyways, the first thing that fascinated me, you sent me a list of things, and the one that caught my eye was one man's been around three United States presidents that were assassinated.
And yeah,
I started looking at that, and I went, well, I've got to hear it, because as I was trying to juggle the timeline in my mind. So go ahead, tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, it's just incredible that one man was on the scene when three different U.S. presidents were assassinated. It's just incredible. And that one man was pretty well known himself. It was Robert Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's son, who obviously was with Abraham Lincoln after Lincoln was shot and killed in 1865. And then Robert Lincoln got into politics himself after his father's assassination. And by 1881, 16 years later, he was in the cabinet of President James Garfield. And Garfield was leaving on a train trip from the Washington Railroad Station. The cabinet went down to say goodbye to him because they had some unfinished business. And a guy comes up to Garfield, a man described as a disappointed office seeker. He was a guy that thought Garfield had promised him a job, and he didn't get the job. In any case, point blank, they didn't have Secret Service like we do today. They didn't have security around Garfield. This guy came up and point blank shot and killed President Garfield. And Robert Lincoln was standing about 2 feet away from Garfield when Garfield was shot. So that was in 1881. And then, incredibly, exactly 20 years after that, in 1901, by that time, Robert Lincoln had left politics. He went into business and became head of the Pullman Company, which was a big deal in those days. And because he was head of the Pullman Company, he was elected president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. There was a business exposition in Buffalo and President William McKinley invited Robert Lincoln to come to the exhibition, to the business exposition, since he was head of the Pullman Company and head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And just as Robert Lincoln walked in the exhibition hall where this exhibition was, there was a receiving line with President McKinley there, and a man got into the receiving line with a revolver hidden. He had his hand bandaged, and of course they didn't have metal detectors in those days, and this guy was able to get in the line with the gun hidden under his bandaged hand, and he was described as an anarchist who wanted to kill a president. Anyhow, he comes up to McKinley and shot and assassinated President McKinley, and there was Robert Lincoln again standing just a few feet away from a president when a president was shot. So after that, Robert Lincoln vowed that he would never get near a president again, and as we say in our book, the All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts, probably nobody would have invited him anyhow.
I'm just sitting here thinking, even if he would have said that, I'd probably be like, no, you just stay away.
Yeah, and Jim, he lived another 25 years. He died in 1926, and he built a beautiful home in Vermont, in Manchester, Vermont, which is a big shopping area in that town of Manchester, Vermont. And his home, which is really a beautiful mansion, is still there. It's open to the public. People can see where he lived. And as I say, he lived there till 1926, never went to Washington the rest of his life, and of course never got anywhere near a president. But it's just amazing that, you know, one person would be on the scene when three different presidents were assassinated. It's just an amazing fact. We have that in our book, The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts.
Now, I might be confused about this, so don't slap me too hard if I am, because it's early in the show. Didn't he save John Wilkes Booth's brother from falling?
Well, that's a great story. When his father was president, Robert Lincoln was going to Harvard, and he was coming home on a school vacation from Harvard, from Boston, back to Washington to be with the family. And he had a chance. Of course, most people traveled by trains in those days. There were no airplanes or automobiles. This is in the early 1860s. So anyhow, he's taking a train from Boston to Washington, but he had to change trains in Newark, New Jersey. And he's standing on a railroad platform in Newark waiting for his next train to come. And the platform was real crowded, and he was standing near the edge of the platform, and he either fell or got pushed accidentally off the platform onto the tracks just as a train was coming. And there was a man standing right there who saw that, and this man reached down and pulled Robert Lincoln up off the tracks just before the train came. Probably saved his life, because there's a question whether he could have gotten up off the tracks by himself, a question whether the train would have seen him, whether the train would have stopped in time. Anyhow, this guy, in effect, saved Robert Lincoln's life as he pulled Robert Lincoln up off the tracks and back onto the platform. The man who did that was a famous Shakespearean actor of the day. His name was Edwin Booth. And it would be Edwin Booth's brother, who was a black sheep of the family, John Wilkes Booth, who would be the man in a few years who would be the one who assassinated Robert Lincoln's father, Abraham Lincoln. And we know that story is true. We did a lot of research on that, and there's a letter that Robert Lincoln wrote to Edwin Booth sometime after that, basically thanking him for saving his life. And Edwin Booth was so thrilled to get that letter, so grateful to get that letter, since he was so upset that his brother had been the one who assassinated Lincoln. He kept that letter, and that letter is in the Smithsonian Institution today, which, you know, proves the point that it was Edwin Booth, John Wilkes Booth's brother, who, in effect, saved Robert Lincoln's life, or, you know, at least saved him from very serious injury or a fatal injury. So it's just an amazing coincidence that it would be Edwin Booth who saved Robert Lincoln, and then Edwin Booth's brother, later the one to assassinate Robert's father.
Let's pause there and think about how much it took to send that letter. Because there are people that I'm mad at that I wouldn't send the letter to. Well, I guess there is a letter, but, well, long walk off the pier kind of deal.
He was grateful, though, to Edwin Booth, you know, as upset as he was. Edwin Booth's brother, that John Wilkes Booth, was a real black sheep of the family. The Booth family was very famous. In fact, Edwin Booth is in the Hall of Fame for Great Americans because he was one of the leading actors of the day. And that family was very well thought of, all except for John Wilkes Booth, who, as I say, was like the black sheep of the family and never quite made it as an actor. Oddly enough, he acted in a play at Ford's Theater in Washington a few months before he went back there, and that's where he shot Abraham Lincoln in Ford's Theater.
Yeah, John Wilkes Booth had, well, we're both from Western Pennsylvania. John Wilkes had some oil interests, but he was never, he was here for a brief period of time. I read some book, it was kind of weird. It was from, like, back in the day, like 1880s. So it was, like, you know, good reports about the stuff, but it was not happy to be here. And I can't,
Yeah.
But you got to try to, you know, gamble that money, I guess, unless you're going to gamble that money. Six, one, half,
right.
The other. So, the other so there's the thing, the connections between Lincoln and Kennedy, but hold on just a second. The other fascinating thing about Lincoln to me is more than once people tried to steal his body.
Hmm.
Did you know that?
No, I never heard that. No, no.
To the point where they had to dig a deep hole and cover it with cement so nobody would try to, because he was in, you know, there's the little, I don't know what the technical term is, but I want to say, like, room inside the tomb. They're cutting, trying to get, look that up. It's phenomenal to me that they were trying to kidnap a body for, they're going to try to ransom him, trying to make money.
And that's something, yeah. Well,
Let's get into these, because I've seen a list of these ties, and then I've seen another list that says, well, these ones aren't true. So where are we with this knowledge about the Lincoln-Kennedy connections?
Well, these are all true. There's no question. I'll go through the – we get a lot of nice comments on this from – it's in our book, the all-time book, Fascinating Facts. This runs a couple pages. I'll just try to remember as many as I can. of the similarities between the assassinations of Kennedy and Lincoln. Let's start with the fact that and it's just incredible, it's eerie almost, how many connections there are, how many coincidences there are between the two assassinations. Both Kennedy and Lincoln were shot on a Friday. In both cases, they were sitting next to their wife when they were shot. Neither wife was hurt. There are seven letters in Lincoln's name and Kennedy's name. Lincoln was elected president in 1860, Kennedy in 1960. They were both succeeded by men named Johnson. Lincoln was succeeded by Andrew Johnson, Kennedy by Lyndon Johnson. Andrew Johnson was born in 1808. Lyndon Johnson was born in 1908. Both names, Andrew Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, have 13 letters in their names. The two assassins both had three-word names, John Wilkes Booth, who shot Lincoln, and Lee Harvey Oswald, who shot Kennedy. Exactly 15 letters in both those names, John Wilkes Booth, Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald shot Kennedy from a warehouse and then hid in a theater. Booth shot Lincoln in a theater and then hid in a warehouse. Both Lincoln and Kennedy died in a place with the initials PH. After Lincoln was shot, he was taken across the street to a boarding house. It was called the Peterson House, and that's where he died the next morning. Kennedy, after he was shot, was taken to a hospital in Dallas called Parkland Hospital, also with the initials PH. Lincoln had sons named Robert and Edward. Kennedy had brothers named Robert and Edward. Lincoln's secretary was named, this is great, this is true. Lincoln's secretary was named Kennedy. Kennedy's secretary was named Lincoln. And the final one, Jim, is the car in which Kennedy was riding when he was shot was a Lincoln. Isn't that amazing?
That one gets you, for sure. Yeah. Bad news for Ford Motor Company, though, but, you know.
That's right.
It's fun to see those similarities in things. As weird and, I mean, because, you know, every once in a while, you get one thing that matches up, and you go, oh, that's kind of neat. But when you dig down, and I lost count after 10. Ran out of fingers, so, you know, sorry.
Well, there are a lot. It's just,
yeah, like, and you said there are pages in your book, so that doesn't probably barely scratch the surface of it. So that is not coincidence, as some people would like to point out, that there's something cosmic to that.
Yeah, yeah.
So my live listeners are into the, they're still going about Pluto, and I don't understand. They want it to be a planet again. Because I think everybody's just comfortable with Pluto being a planet. Do you have any?
It's very close, you know, in size. It, of course, was the smallest planet, but it's still bigger than, you know, a lot of other bodies. It was considered a planet for many years. It was discovered in the 1930s, got its name. A little girl, by the way, came up with that name. A 13-year-old girl came up with that name, Pluto, for the planet, which has now been degraded, not considered a planet anymore, although some still consider it to be.
So I guess I want to ask them, if we bring it back, do we come back with a new name, and what the new name is? Not for you, just for them, because I want them to keep churning on this deep and profound subject. We also want to get into, okay, so this is another kind of one of their topics. How far can you see on a clear day? Because I swear that you don't see as far as you think you do.
For sure. Well, if you ask most people the question, how far can you see with the naked eye on a clear day, most people probably would say maybe a mile, 2 miles to the horizon. But do you realize that you and I and we, as long as we have our sight with on a clear day, we can see 93 million miles away, right? Because all we have to do is look at the sun, and the sun is roughly 93 million miles away. And even more amazing, Jim, is at nighttime, you know, we can see stars that are billions of miles away. With our naked eye, we can see something that is, you know, 10 billion miles away. It's just, it's amazing when you think about it. But certainly on a nice afternoon, you can easily, with those two eyes of yours, you can easily see 93 million miles away without no questions. That's a good question you can, you know, ask your friends or kids or.
It's on it now. I'm going to ask my son tomorrow. He loves the dad jokes, so I've got it. That's a good answer. So if I take anything, anything away from this show, that'll be it.
I'll give you a good one to ask a little kid. A question we have in the book: why was the number six afraid? Why is the number six afraid? And the answer is because 7, 8, 9.
I heard another one the other day, but I can't remember what it is. It ended up with the punchline being 9 is the square root of 3, but I don't remember the actual joke.
Yeah, or you could say, what's the longest word in the English language? And the answer could be smiles, because there's a mile between the two S's.
Oh, boy.
We have a couple of those little kids' questions in our book. On a more serious note,
I was going to say, now we've got to transition back to something more serious, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe I just should sit here and laugh for the next 40 minutes. Oh, probably can't. Let's go back to Rose Kennedy, because that was kind of, I guess we kind of, as I was scrolling the notes here a little bit, 104 years old. First, congratulations on living that long. But I can't imagine living through all that in the midst of trying to be... as a parent, I'd just be horrified, let alone the level of what they were doing.
It's a heck of a story, Jim. Again, we have it in the all-time book of Fascinating Facts. What happened to that family? I mean, here's a family that really basically had everything. They had money, a lot of money. They had power. They had prestige. Rose's father was a mayor of Boston, a big political figure. Joseph Kennedy, the father, was Her husband, who the father of President Kennedy, was a very wealthy, successful businessman, politician. He was in did work for President Roosevelt. Anyhow, as I say, the family had everything except the tragedies that family went through. And here's Rose Kennedy, the mother, who lived through all this and lived so long through all this. And let me just, again, I'll do this from memory. It's in our book. But let's start with the fact their first son, Joseph Jr., was killed in World War II. Their next child was a daughter who was killed in a plane crash in the late 1940s. The next daughter had mental problems, had a failed lobotomy when she was about 12 years old, and spent the rest of her life in a mental institution. Their next child was Jack Kennedy, who obviously became president but was assassinated at age 45. He was assassinated. The next child was Robert Kennedy, also assassinated. And then you had the grandchildren. One grandchild of Rose Kennedy's was killed in a skiing accident. He ran into a tree and was killed. Another one died of drug overdose. Another one had a leg removed from cancer. And here's Rose Kennedy living through all this, seeing all her children being killed and dying at early ages in real tragedies. And she lived through all this, as I say, to 104. And the final one, John Kennedy's son, John Kennedy Jr., was also killed in a plane crash. Some people may remember that. He was flying to Hyannisport with his wife and sister-in-law, and their plane crashed in the ocean there. And here's Rose Kennedy living through all these, all her children being killed and grandchildren. And as I say, as you say, and as we say, it's true, she lived to the age of 104. She was very religious, and that, you know, certainly helped her. She had met two different popes, and she had a weekly or daily, almost a daily visit from a priest in her parish, and, that undoubtedly helped her get through all this. But just imagine living through all this, seeing all your children and grandchildren being killed in, so prematurely. It's just, losing one child would be bad enough, but she lost so many.
It is just amazing to ponder going through all that time and time and time and time again.
Right.
So let's shift gears for just a couple minutes here, because this fascinates me, because I have 11 books on my note sheet here. Is that accurate?
11 of our books, yeah. Actually, this is number 12, the new one.
Okay, well, I guess after two or three, I guess this kind of becomes just a compilation number. It's impressive the amount of work. But what made you want to do number one?
Well, it all started, Jim, it leads to a very interesting fact. When I was a kid, I loved radio. And this is many years ago. I was a journalist for 50-some years, so this is long, long time ago. I was a kid, and I got a job. As I say, I love radio, and I went to a radio station in Pittsburgh and got a job as what we today would be called an intern. They didn't call it that in those days. Anyhow, my job was to clear the news as it came across the newswire. We obviously didn't have computers in those days. We had teletypes, and you had to tear the sheets of paper off the teletype as the news came in. So anyhow, they had me working on, since I was the youngest one there, they had me working on July 4th on the holiday. And I was just, looking at the news as it came over the teletypes. And a feature story from the Associated Press came over that three of the first five U.S. presidents all died on July 4th. And I thought, boy, that's an amazing fact. I don't think I ever learned that in school. And I looked it up, and it certainly is true. Three of the first five U.S. presidents all died on July 4th, all of unrelated causes. What are the odds on that? The second president, John Adams, died on July 4th, 1826. He lived in Massachusetts. The same day, July 4th, 1826, Thomas Jefferson, the third president, died in Virginia. And another significance there is that that was the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1826, as opposed to July 4th, 1776. And both Jefferson and Adams, who were so involved in the Declaration of Independence, died on that 50th anniversary of it. And then the fifth president, James Monroe, also died on July 4th, 1831. And, you know, what are the odds, first of all, that three of the first five presidents would all die on the same day, on the same date? And of all the dates in the year, it would be July 4th. I mean, it's just, when you stop to think about that, it's just incredible. And we almost had four of the first five presidents dying on July 4th, because the fourth president, James Madison, died on a June 28th. He almost made it to July 4th. So we almost had four of the first five presidents dying on July 4th. So anyhow, I thought, boy, that's an amazing fact. And I wrote it down, and I was about 15, 16 years old then, and I just started my desire to look for stories like that. And so I started collecting things like that. When I got out of school, I started a company called Century Features, where we syndicated interesting facts. It was a newspaper syndication column to papers in the U.S. and Canada. And then I did that for, as I say, 50-some years, and finally people said, why don't you put some of this stuff in books, and that started my book series, Knowledge in a Nutshell. And then I decided finally to take what I think is the best of all the stuff I have over the years and put it in this one final book, which we have today, the All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. I took what I consider the best of what we had, plus I took a couple of years to look, you know, for some new stuff, too. So the result is the All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. So anyhow, that's how it all started. And that's a heck of a story. You know, the more you think about it, that three of the first five presidents all died on, of all dates, on July 4th.
That's quite the statistical, some statistician out there is blowing their heads out right now trying to figure that
out. Yeah.
So you're saying this is the last book. Is that what I just heard you say?
Yeah, as I say, I just took the best of what I think is the best of what I have, and this is my my final book, and you know, I just wanted to put the best of everything I have in this one volume. And we called it the All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts.
So are you still out gathering? Are you still out gathering facts, though?
No, this is it, and I tried to make it timely, so it wouldn't get out of date. There's nothing in there really that I can't foresee anything getting out of date. We did have to make one change. It's kind of an interesting story. We have a story in here about what's the longest running show in America. And when I wrote the book, the answer was the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, which started back in the 1880s and was still running when I started writing the book in 1916. I mean, in 2016. And wouldn't you know it, just a few months after the book came out, the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus ceased to exist. So we had to change the, we did change the copy, so it's still accurate. It still holds the record as the longest running show in America, but in the book, originally we said it's still running, and then we made that change that it stopped in 2017. But still holds the record as the longest running show in America. And there's a story, it's pretty interesting, about the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. They were all kind of interesting people, and they merged into that one show which ran so long.
Yeah, I was going to say, it has to be a fascinating relationship, because anytime you go into a partnership with people, it can create tension, and, you know, because somebody has their ideas and they're set in their ways, and obviously, as you look across the way, they're setting their ways, too. Had to be some interesting things going on back then.
For sure, no question, yeah.
So, what's the active, like, the active longest-running show? Do you know?
I don't know what that would be. I have to do some research on it. That's a good question, Jim. It'd be kind of hard to break the record of, you know... the circus, that Ringling Brothers Barnum Bailey Circus, went from, as I say, the 1880s all the way to the 2000s. So, you know, went all through the 1900s. And so it ran more than 100 years. You don't get many shows doing that, that's for sure.
Too soon to mention Congress, as I refrain from using Mark Twain references at this point. No.
Well, we have a story about Mark Twain, as a matter of fact.
Oh, let's go there then, because what a life that guy lived, by the way.
Here's the amazing story. The headline is, how could a person be born in Florida and Missouri? Those states are pretty far apart, so how could a person be born in Florida and Missouri? But somebody was, and of all people, it was Mark Twain. There was a town in northeastern Missouri, the name of the town, Florida, and that's where Mark Twain was born. He went through his life telling people, hey, I was born in Florida, and I was born in Missouri, because he was born in the town of Florida in the state of Missouri, and that's a true story. He was born in Florida, Missouri. So he could safely say he was born in both Florida and Missouri.
So I look over the notes and I see this one. Which U.S. state doesn't exist anymore? Since we're on states at the moment.
You want that story?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, we had a state that doesn't exist anymore. It was a state called Franklin, named after Benjamin Franklin, one of our great founding fathers. And the state was between what is now Tennessee and North Carolina. Right after the Civil War, that state was created, the state of Franklin. And there were all kinds of political and land disputes. And unfortunately, the representatives in Congress from the state of Franklin were in the minority party at the time. And the representatives from Tennessee and North Carolina were in the majority party. Anyhow, Tennessee and North Carolina started taking... the borders were not well defined in those days, and Tennessee started taking part of the land of the state of Franklin, and North Carolina took part. And after 4 years, and there were many battles about this, the state of Franklin ceased to exist. Tennessee took most of that land. North Carolina took some of it. And here the state of Franklin went out of business. And I was telling this story on a radio show one night, and a woman called in from Tennessee, and said she always wondered, there's a highway in eastern Tennessee called the State of Franklin Highway, and she always wondered where that name came from, and she said, I'm glad you told that story, because that road used to go into what was then called the State of Franklin. So the main lesson there, I think, Jim, is here's poor Benjamin Franklin, who certainly deserved to have a state named after him, and did, but doesn't anymore. The state of Franklin ceased to exist after about 4 years, and as I say, most of it is now in eastern Tennessee. A little bit of it is in western North Carolina, so we don't have the state of Franklin anymore. And speaking of that, you would think that we would have more states named after presidents, but we have only one of the 50 states is named after a president, and that's, of course, the state of Washington. But no other state is named after a president. And we almost had Colorado, when the early settlers went there, they called the territory Jefferson after President Thomas Jefferson. But when Congress took the state in, when they got statehood there, for whatever reason, Congress decided to use the name Colorado instead of Jefferson. So anyhow, it leaves us with just one state named after a president.
Let's go back to Benjamin Franklin for a minute, because the chatters brought this up way early. They wanted me to ask you about this. And I guess since we're from Pennsylvania, I'm committed to ask you about Benjamin Franklin wanting the national bird to be a turkey.
Yeah, he was a big turkey fan. And one interesting thing we have in the book is that people say, are turkeys named after the country of Turkey? And the funny thing is, the answer is no. There were no turkeys in the country of Turkey until they were brought there from America. Turkey is strictly a North American bird. It's native only of North America, and a turkey was never in the country of Turkey until we brought them there. And the reason they're called turkeys, it's really a mistake, and Benjamin Franklin is partially responsible for that state, because the early settlers in America, there were a lot of turkeys, particularly in rural areas in those days. That's why turkey became the traditional food for Thanksgiving. At that time, there were so many turkeys in the country, especially in our rural areas. But anyhow, the early settlers here thought they saw so many, what we call now turkeys, they thought they looked like guinea hens that are from the country of Turkey, and so they started calling them, mistakenly, they started calling those guinea hens turkeys after the country of Turkey, even though, as I say, the birds never were in Turkey. Turkeys are native only to North America. And it's interesting, I'm sure it'd be interesting to find out what people thought in the country of Turkey when they finally brought these birds over there and said, hey, here's a turkey named after you, even though you had nothing to do with it.
It has to be the that weird moment when somebody presents you with something you had nothing to do with, and you're like, thanks. Right. This is great. Right. What is this? What's going on here? I could just imagine, horrified as I'd be. You
know, the country of Turkey is, of course, so much in the news now. It's interesting. And so you can think about that at Thanksgiving time, that when you're eating turkey, it's not named after the country of Turkey. It was really misnamed, and no turkeys in the country of Turkey till we brought them there.
Of course we brought them there. That's a whole other. Oh. So we were talking about Benjamin Franklin, who is well known for his academic things. I'm surprised he was never president, but I guess timing didn't work out for him.
He was too old, Jim. He was the oldest of the founding fathers, and he died very shortly after the country was formed. And I think that's the one thing that prevented him from being. George Washington was the obvious choice for first president, but I think if Benjamin Franklin had been younger, it's possible that he would have been the obvious choice for president. And he certainly was very, very influential in the writing of the Constitution and you know, many other things in forming the nation.
Which brings me to your next point, which president could not read or write as a teenager?
And then became president.
And then became amazing. President. That's the American story right there, right? The American dream.
Yeah. If you met this kid when he was 16, 17 years old and was illiterate, and somebody said, hey, someday this guy's going to be president, you know, you'd say it'll never happen, but it did happen. It was Andrew Johnson, who we talked about, as the man who succeeded Abraham Lincoln. He was Lincoln's vice president. When he was from a very poor family, a little town in Tennessee, Greenville, Tennessee, and his father died. He had to go to work. When he was 7, 8 years old, he became an apprentice to a tailor and then worked during his childhood, which was not totally unusual in those days. Some kids never went to school. George Washington is another example of that, by the way. He basically worked on the family's plantation as a kid, and rarely went to school. But anyhow, Andrew Johnson never went to school, never learned to read or write. So by the time he's 16 years old, here's this teenager, illiterate, and who would ever predict he'd become president someday. But he had a girlfriend named Eliza McCardle, and she taught him to read and write, never dreaming that while she was teaching this kid to read and write, that's not only would he become president someday, but that she would become first lady of the land. But that's what happened. They got married when they were about 19 years old, and now the newly literate Andrew Johnson went into politics in this little town of Greenville, Tennessee. By the time he was 25, he was elected mayor of the town, and he went into a political life. I was elected eventually to the legislature in Tennessee, the state House of Representatives in Tennessee. Then he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. And then meantime, he had married Eliza McCardle. Meantime, fast forward to Lincoln running for a second term. The Civil War was drawing to a close, and Lincoln is vice president from the term, because Lincoln was a Republican, He wanted a Southern Democrat to be his vice president because he wanted to show that that was trying to unify the country. So he picked Andrew Johnson out of the Senate. By that time, Andrew Johnson was the U.S. Senator, to be his vice president, since Andrew Johnson was a Southern Democrat. Lincoln thought that would help unify the country, Lincoln being a Northern Republican. So he picked Andrew Johnson, and then, of course, as fate would have it, Lincoln was shot and killed shortly after his second term began, and Andrew Johnson became president. And here's a guy that couldn't read or write as a kid and as a teenager, and now he's president of the United States, and his wife, who taught him to read and write, is the first lady of the land. So that's a heck of a story.
And reflect on what you just said there. A Republican picked a Democrat for vice president.
Right. Right. Wouldn't happen today.
As I say, I'm doing a prediction show for 2020 next week. That's not going to be part of my predictions.
Yeah, I don't think that'll happen again. No.
I mean, it'd be a phenomenal move. I don't know if it'd win, but it'd just be... But anyways, that's just...
Yeah, well, Lincoln did it for, as I say, good reason. He was trying to, you know, unify the country after the Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, it is a good reason, but I think, I mean, honestly, today, I think we're just as volatile, well, maybe not as volatile, but getting close to that point. But
yeah, I don't think we'll have that. No, also, we probably won't have any president who couldn't read or write as a kid, as a teenager.
Well, some days probably I might think, I was going to say, some days it might not be the worst thing we've ever had, but anyways, before I get myself in trouble. Let's fast forward a few years out of the Johnson administration and go to the War of 1812 and the Star Spangled Banner and the Betsy Ross flag. Do you have anything fun there?
Well, interestingly enough, the Star Spangled Banner was written during the War of 1812, as you say. It's surprising it wasn't made the national anthem until 1931. Herbert Hoover, president, then signed the bill that made it the national anthem. We didn't have a national anthem for all those years. And a couple of other interesting things about the Star Spangled Banner. First of all, the words United States and the word America never appear in the Star Spangled Banner, and that's unusual for a national anthem. If you look at all four verses of Star Spangled Banner, the words United States and America are nowhere there. And if you went to a ball game, Jim, in, let's say, 1925, a football game or baseball game, basketball game, they wouldn't say before the game, ladies and gentlemen, here's the national anthem, because we didn't have a national anthem. And they didn't play anything before games in those days. For one thing, there were no PA systems in the old days, but even into the 1930s, and when we did have a national anthem, the custom was not to play the national anthem before a sports event. It didn't start to happen until World War II, when just as a patriotic gesture, they started playing the Star Spangled Banner, originally just on special days like opening day or for the All-Star Game or World Series, but then they started playing it every day as World War II went on, just to be patriotic, and it was thought that that custom would end at the end of World War II, but it didn't. It just continued. In fact, it grew. You know, now even high school, like high school basketball games, they play it. So, you know, that really is a relatively new custom to play it before all games. And when you stop to think about it, and this is kind of funny, we mentioned this in the book, that at no other event do we play the national anthem. You go to a theater to see a play or a movie, and during World War II, at those times, they did play the national anthem in many cases. Radio stations played it at the beginning of the day and the end of the day, which they don't do anymore. But sports events are really the only place where we do play the national anthem. So I say it's kind of funny when you think about it. You go see a play or a movie, they don't play the national anthem before. So there's a lot of interesting things about the national anthem written by Francis Scott Key. Another interesting fact about the Star Spangled Banner is he was not a songwriter. So our famous national anthem was not written by a songwriter. He was a lawyer, and The reason he wrote the words, he had been sent as a lawyer to Fort McHenry to try to get a prisoner that the British were holding, an American prisoner, freed. And he was out on the bay there during the battle of Fort McHenry. And the next morning, he wasn't sure if the British had won, because there were bombs bursting all night. He wasn't sure if the British had won the Battle of Fort McHenry or if America had won it. And at dawn's early light, when it started to get light and the smoke and the fog cleared, he saw the American flag was still there. And that caused him to write the famous words, "Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light that our flag was still there?" That's the reason he wrote it to begin with. As I say, he was there as a lawyer, not as a songwriter. So there's a lot of interesting facts about the Star-Spangled Banner.
So let's go back to baseball for a minute. When did we start doing the seventh-inning stretch?
Well, there's a couple theories on that. The most prevalent one is that the first president to attend a game was William Howard Taft. He was a big baseball fan, and he went to a game in Washington. Oddly enough, Washington, again, has a franchise. But the old Washington Senators were in the American League in those days. And this is in the late 1909, I think it was. He was president from 1909 to 1913, William Howard Taft. Anyhow, he went to a ball game. Throughout the first pitch, he started the custom of famous people throwing out the first pitch. But he had to get back to the White House for whatever reason when the last of the seventh was coming around. So he was sitting in a box seat in the front row behind the dugout, and he got up to leave in the middle of the seventh inning. And out of respect, as Taft got up to leave and started to walk out, people in the stands got up to leave. Got up to stretch or got up out of their seats to honor President Taft. And as it turned out, Washington, which was behind at that time, the Washington Senators team, they had a big rally in the last of the seventh and won the game, and the custom started that might be a good luck charm to stand up in the middle of the seventh. That's one theory as to where it came from, and then they started doing that in Washington all the time, standing up in the middle of the seventh inning for a seventh inning stretch. Another theory is that I think it was at Fordham, which is a Catholic school. One of the priests there thought his pupils were not paying attention to the game, and he had them stand up in the middle of the seventh inning to stretch just as a way to get them starting to pay attention again. And again, they had a big rally in the last of the seventh, and that's another theory. That's where that tradition came from. That's another reason that tradition came, to give us a seventh-inning stretch, which, of course, which story is true, or maybe parts of both stories are true. I tend to believe the one with President Taft, because we know that did happen. We know he was the first president to attend a Major League Baseball game and to throw out the first pitch, and you know, his leaving was a big event there, and people did get up and they did have the rally. That's all been checked and that's true. So that's probably where the seventh inning stretch came from.
Well, it sounds good. Makes a good story. Better story than the other one, for sure. if I was gonna write the stories on what I want to hear, I think the President Taft story is much better. Now I want to dig for you. I mean, I know you're of an age. I don't know if you did or not. Did you go to Forbes Field at all as a child?
In fact, I was an usher there, would you believe?
I was going to say, take me back there. Tell me, I mean, goodness. At the All-Star Game in Pittsburgh 13 years ago. Oh, good God. I had the pleasure of sitting beside a guy. Well, it wasn't his seat, but he came down and sat beside me for some reason. And he started telling me stories about Forbes Field and Bobby. And Bobby is Roberto Clemente. About how he'd just roam the neighborhood and hang out, and you know, and I was just sitting there fascinated by these stories he was telling me from his childhood. So I'm assuming you probably have some other interesting stories about that.
It was a great ballpark, and it was in a neighborhood area. It's where the University of Pittsburgh basically is. And by the way, the part of the fence is still there, even though the park was torn down years ago. But where Mazeroski hit the home run to win the 1960 World Series, the seventh game of the 1960 World Series, they still have part of that wall is still there. It's on the University of Pittsburgh campus now. But the wall is there, and there's a plaque which says, you know, this is the wall over which Mazeroski hit the home run to win the 1960 World Series over the New York Yankees. And it was on October 13th, by the way, 1960, that seventh game of the World Series. And every year now, on the October 13th, they have a ceremony there. And Mazeroski's a few times, he's still living. And there's a group of people that they have a tape of the broadcast of the game, so they play the broadcast of the seventh game of the World Series, and one of the most exciting games in history, where the score was tied going into the last of the ninth, seventh game, and Mazeroski hit a home run over the left field wall, and so they have a recording of that, and they celebrate that every October 13th. It was a great ballpark, beautiful ballpark. Beyond the outfield is a park, a Schenley Park in Pittsburgh, so you had trees growing out there if you were sitting, you know, looking out over the fence. And they had the old-fashioned bleachers there. And one other interesting fact about Forbes Field, Babe Ruth hit his last three home runs in Major League Baseball at Forbes Field. And not only that, he was with the Boston Braves at that time. He's in the National League after leaving the New York Yankees. The first home run he hit went in the lower deck of the right field stands. The second home run he hit went into the upper deck of the right field stands. And the third home run he hit that day went over the roof. And he became the first player ever to hit a home run over the roof in right field stands of Forbes Field. And those were the last three home runs he ever hit, and of course he held the record for many years for the most home runs.
Just a
so the park had lots of memories.
Yeah, as I say, just a fascinating place, and then they moved into that tire fire. I mean, Free River Stadium.
Yeah, and those stadiums, a lot of teams did that. Didn't work out too well where they used them for both football and baseball. You really need a separate ballpark for baseball, I think, and just because of the uniqueness of that sport as opposed to football. And, you know, so most cities now have a separate stadium for baseball and a separate one for football.
Yeah. I'm glad it worked out that way. I'm much, much happier being in either venue now than I was being at Free River Stadium. But that's a whole bunch of other sports stories for another time. So now that you've kind of put a nail on these books, what are you looking forward to doing now?
Well, no, that's about it. I just want to have this book become, some people said it's the best trivia book of all time. I don't know about that, but I appreciate that comment. And you can have a lot of fun with it. Families like it. It's good for kids and adults. If I can read you what, I've worked for CBS and my old boss at CBS, Constance Lloyd, who was the news director there, she gave us this quote, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead, yes.
This is on the cover of the book. It says, the information here is fabulous and so appealing because of the I bet you didn't know spirit in all of us who like to stump our friends and savor the interesting information for ourselves. So, I hope that is what the book is. You can have. We got a letter the other day from a woman who said she was on a long automobile trip with her husband, and they passed the hours by her asking him all these questions from the book. And then each story has the headline is a question, and then we have the story. It's not just a one word, you know, one sentence answer. It's a little story about each one. So you can use it as a quiz book and have some fun with it and we hope learn some things too. And
Well, I think it's the kind of the crux of all good conversation, though. If you get somebody with some random fact, there's a genuine conversation that follows.
Yeah, we tried to make it so it's, we have all kinds of, we have sports, we have presidential facts, we have geography, we have a lot of food facts. So, you know, like hamburgers, why in the world do we call them hamburgers? Do you ever stop to think there's no ham in hamburgers? So why in the world do we call them hamburgers?
Can I confuse some poor clerk at McDonald's with that one?
Well, the answer is that we had a lot of German immigrants came to the United States in the late 1800s, and the people from Hamburg, Germany, the town of Hamburg, Germany, brought with them their custom of serving ground meat, which was unusual in those days. So people here started calling ground meat hamburgers after the city of Hamburg, Germany. So the name comes from the fact, not that there's any ham in hamburgers, but from the city of origin, Hamburg, Germany. So anyhow, the next time you're having a hamburger with a friend, you can say, hey, there ain't no ham here. Why do we call them hamburgers? And you got the answer there. And that's very similar, by the way, Jim, to Frankfurters, got their name from Frankfurt, Germany, where they were made. And Wieners, that name comes from Vienna. The German pronunciation for Vienna is Wien. They spell it W-E-I-N and pronounce it Wien. And Wien, and that's where Wieners came from. But I like the one on hamburgers. And then we have a lot of things like why police officers are called cops. You know, it's a good variety of questions in the book. And if I may say, your listeners can go to our website, knowledgeinanutshell.com. You can see the book there and order it if you like. There's a discount. Some people buy a bunch of them to give as Christmas gifts or birthday gifts. There's a little discount if you take more than one. The price of the book, by the way, is $19.95, and that includes the shipping and handling. So the name of the website is knowledgeinanutshell.com. You'll see the book there and read about it, and there's an order form. The name of the book is, the website's knowledgeinanutshell.com. The name of the book is The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. It's also on Amazon if you prefer to do that, or we have an 800 number, too, if you want to do it that way, 1-800-NUTSHELL. So we invite folks to sample the book.
All right. Dr. Knowledge, it has been fun, and I can hear the radio in you, and it makes me excited, makes me happy.
Well, nothing like radio, right, Jim?
Yeah. So thank you. I'm sure we'll talk again, though.
Well, I hope so.
This might be the last book, but I'm not done with you yet.
Well, no, we have a lot more to talk about, that's for sure.
Have a good evening, sir.
With you, Jim. Thank you so much.
And that's Dr. Knowledge there, hanging out with us on the Maurer Report. What a great guest. That hour, I love this hour. I was talking about that earlier. What a great guest. Okay, before I get to my iTunes review, which I'm encouraging people to go over and read, or you can come to Maurer.com/reviews and leave one there if you're not an iTunes person. I want to mention the Duck Pond people that I've seen. I want to give a quick shout-out to Kat of Paranormal Heart. She is out on an investigation night, so good luck and stay safe out there. I seen Brian Bowden. I seen Roy hanging out for a little bit. I see Germantown Runner. I see Walks at Night. I see WR250. Anybody that I may have missed during the course of the show, I am sorry, but next time make a bigger impression. Okay. So another, I promised one of the other bad reviews. So here we go. I, like the previous person, have heard many paranormal podcasts, and this one has to be the absolute worst. There are a ton of podcasts out there, and there's a small handful of really good paranormal ones. Right? Okay. Typically, I listen to the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold. Good friend of mine, by the way. I did his show a while ago. If I think it's part of his membership program, but I know a guy who can get you a link to actually listen to it if you want to hear me with Jim Harold. Jim's podcast is far more polished, but this Farside one isn't bad at all. Farside isn't making shows anymore. Much better than this Maurer Report. Having said all that, to say this, I love it. You'll hear this podcast coming out in a couple months. Amazingly, this guy is booked out a couple months, and he wanted to still talk to me. Phenomenal. You'll hear more about my paranormal podcast journey. I can't wait to share that with you all. Like I said, probably around Christmas, by the sounds of it, if not the first of the new year. So, like I said, Mallard.com/reviews, iTunes reviews, share, like, review, all this fun stuff going on. Oh, I should almost need to mention this. We're almost out of time, and I have not said this yet. Happy Halloween, everybody. Stay safe. Keep the kids out of traffic. Check the candy, because there's a lot of horrible people in the world. But seriously, have a good time with it. That's Mallard.com. See you next week.
Hip Pass Moto, sponsored by Moto America, is the show that keeps you up to speed on the latest in motorcycling and brings the biggest names in motorcycle racing right to you. From candid interviews with the top names in racing to providing insights into the trends and trendsetters driving the motorcycle industry, we have you covered. New episodes are available every Thursday at pitpassmoto.com and on your favorite podcast app. Ride on!